This is Alan B. Chinnan, M.D., Once Upon a Midlife, Fairy Tales, May 7th, 1993.
Later to introduce our speaker for tonight's talk and as well as tomorrow's workshop. Alan Chinnan is a psychiatrist who lives in the San Francisco area. He is practicing there in private practice, and somehow, I'm not quite sure how, but I think we'll learn, he has become very interested in fairy tales. Two of his books, In the Ever After and Once Upon a Midlife, are books that I have greatly enjoyed, and particularly I'm looking forward to the topic tonight, which is about the middle, the tales of midlife, or tales of adulthood. And I find for myself reaching that area of life has been difficult, and it was very helpful for me to read this book, and I'm looking forward now to hearing him speak, and I'd like to welcome Alan Chinnan.
Thank you. We're trying an experiment here with this high chair. Hopefully I won't fall off. But I thought an unstable ground would make me feel at home, since California, the ground is always moving. Well, the topic tonight may seem a little odd, fairy tales for adults, but it's one of my great interests. most of us here probably love fairy tales, and we all probably have a few favorites from childhood or from other times. And if you think about it, most of these familiar stories are about children or adolescents or young people. And they all have a similar theme or similar plot, where you have a young man and a young woman meet, the hero and heroine. They fall in love. They battle terrible enemies like dragons, witches, and trolls. Then they prove triumphant. They marry. And then the story tells us they live happily ever after. Well, as you all probably know by now, life doesn't really happen that way. And the stories I'll be telling you tell us what happens in this happy ever after, when the prince goes bald and the princess has a midlife crisis and they both have to deal with children. The stories I'll be telling you today and also in the workshop tomorrow are specifically about adults. I define them as folk tales, fairy tales, with the adults are called neither young nor old. These are called the middle tales. They're somewhere in the middle of life. And these protagonists all either are married or have a job or both. And if you think about it, those are pretty much the defining characteristics about the middle third of life. Like Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty are neither married nor have a job. I'll be telling you some stories and then discussing them. And as you'll see, they probably would be unfamiliar to you. And the reason for this is that the predominant number of fairy tales that are known are actually about children, as I mentioned. And only about 15% are about people at midlife. And then maybe another 5% are about people who are specifically called old, which I call elder tales. And the way I located these middle tales and elder tales was a very simple-minded method. I just read 5,000 fairy tales and picked out the ones that were the protagonists were middle-aged or older. This took a number of years, but it was actually a fun research project. When the stories are grouped together by the age of the protagonist, it's amazing how much cross-cultural similarity there are. Middle stories basically are the same around the world, no matter what culture they come from, underscoring the archetypal nature of these tales and the fact that there are just certain basic tasks that we all have to negotiate as we go through midlife, for better or for worse. Now, I often asked how I began with such a strange project for an adult, and there's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is that I never grew up. So I always loved fairy tales. But that probably is true of most of us here, too. We probably all love fairy tales. The long answer is more complicated, and it begins a number of years ago, actually more than 10 years ago, when I'd be meditating or jogging or just taking a walk on the beach. I get vivid images of people or places, and they seem to be fairy tale stories. And they had kings and castles and dragons. And I thought, well, these stories seem to be asking, seem to be the endings of stories, and they seem to be asking rather for not interpretation, but elaboration. So I sat down and wrote the stories to get to how these people ended up in these images, which were the endings. And I noticed something very peculiar, that they're all about middle-aged or older people. And I thought, I've never come across traditional fairy tales like that. But I figured, well, if I came up with something like this, many other people through the years have also. So I just started looking in the library, and what I found were real treasures. I mean, these are jewels that have been neglected for a long time. I should mention as a definition, by fairy tales I mean folk stories, which means these are handed down orally from generation to generation. And so I exclude literary fairy tales like those written by Oscar Wilde or Hans Christian Andersen. And the reason for this is that folk stories, in the process of being passed down from generation to generation, the idiosyncratic elements of the stories are eliminated in sort of like a process of natural selection. So only the universal themes remain. But in stories by individual authors like Hans Christian Andersen, the individual psychology remains. So if you read some of his stories, they do have some peculiar peculiarities about them. The second definition of fairy tales would be that they're stories that are not meant to be believed, as opposed to myths or legends, which are supposed to be believed because they're about the gods, saints, and kings and ancestors. This, as we'll see, is a great advantage, because fairy tales allow you to suspend belief and therefore to discuss any topic or come up with any kind of idea. It can often be heretical and, as we'll see, very subversive. That's one of the virtues of stories about midlife. And the last definition about fairy tales is that they're about ordinary human people, not the gods or superheroes. And this is also an advantage because, if you think about it, gods never get old. Whereas people like us do. So fairy tales deal with ordinary people who do get old and who do worry about dying, whereas gods can live forever and they do all sorts of horrible things and nothing ever happens to them. But that's not true of fairy tales, or real life for that matter. But rather than talk about the stories, I thought what I'd do is tell you some of them, and then we can discuss what comes up for you with them, your reactions or images or impressions. I have to emphasize that these are folk tales, which mean they belong to the folk, to the people, and so that there's no one right interpretation. These are not scriptures. So whatever impression that you have would be important to bring up. And I'm always amazed that in giving workshops over a number of years, that every time I give a talk or a workshop, somebody brings up, or several people bring up, new ideas or new interpretations. I have two caveats before I begin. The first one is, these middle tales begin where traditional youth tales like Cinderella leave off. And that is to say, they assume that you finished the psychological business of childhood, like getting over mother complexes and father complexes. Now, if you know anybody who has actually done that, please come up. But then I remind you, these are fairy tales. They're fairy tales, and so they're short, so they can't deal with everything. They're not novels, so they eliminate the childhood stuff and focus on the new issues that arise at midlife. The second warning I have is that these stories may not be what you expect from other fairy tales like Cinderella, Snow White, which are usually heartwarming and moving and bring a tear to your eye and give you kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling. Middle tales are disturbing. And actually often disheartening, but they're always very accurate, very realistic, and ultimately they have a lot of hope and wisdom in them. What I thought I'd do is start with a tale that may be familiar to many of you because it comes from the Grimm's Fairy Tale Collection, which is probably the most well-known of all fairy tale collections. Just as an aside, it's an interesting statistic that the number two bestseller in Germany over the last century for books has been the Grimm's Fairy Tales, number two after the number one bestseller, which is the Bible, which is an interesting statistic. So it's reassuring it outsold Mein Kampf. Well, the story that I want to begin with will introduce us to the first issues of midlife, and they follow certain stages, or certain issues come up at different times. And this would be the initial period. entering the middle third of life. And it's called The Elves and the Shoemaker, which may be familiar to a lot of you. Once upon a time, long ago, there lived a shoemaker with his wife. He worked very hard, but times were difficult. There was a major recession and taxes kept going up, until he found he had nothing left in his shop except one piece of leather. He didn't know what he would do after this was gone, because business was so terrible, but he wasn't one to despair, so he sat down at his workbench and carefully cut out the piece of leather, planning to sew a pair of shoes. But by the time he finished, it was night, and so he put everything on his work table and went home for dinner with his wife. The next morning he woke up and went to his workshop, and he was astonished. All the pieces of leather had been sewed together into the most beautiful pair of shoes he had ever seen. He was flabbergasted. Who came in the middle of the night and did this great favor for him? And when he looked at the shoes, he saw that the workmanship was exquisite, the best he had ever seen. Well, he couldn't figure out who had done this, but he was a very practical man, so he immediately sold the shoes, and with the money, and he made a tidy profit, he bought two hides of leather, and he sat down, cut it out, planning to sew two pairs of shoes. But by then it was evening, so he left everything on his work table and went home for dinner with his wife. The next morning he went to his workshop, and guess what he found? Somebody had come in again and sewed everything, all the pieces of leather, into two beautiful pairs of boots. Well, the shoemaker was flabbergasted, but he immediately sewed the shoes and bought more hides of leather. He cut it out, left it out overnight, and the same thing happened every night and every morning. Somebody came in and sewed all the leather up into sandals, boots, and shoes, and they were so wonderfully made that he soon had this great reputation. People came from all over to buy his shoes. Well, he and his wife were now quite prosperous, but they wondered who it was who was helping them. And they started talking and said, well, we really have to find out so we can thank whoever it is who's giving us this help. I mean, we were really down to the last penny when this happened. So they decided that they would spy in the workshop at night to find out who their mysterious helper was so they could figure out a way to thank this person. The husband and wife hid in the closet, and they both peered out of two little knot holes in the door. Well, night fell, darkness came, the moon rose, and the hours went by. And then right around midnight, they heard laughing and singing in the distance. And before they knew it, two tiny elves jumped in the window, did somersaults, and started dancing. And the elves were as naked as dawn, but they didn't care. They did more somersaults, they did dancing and laughing. And every time they did a somersault, they sold another pair of shoes. And every time they twirled around with another dance, they sold another pair of boots. The husband and his wife were astonished. They could barely keep quiet. Elves are helping us. They didn't say it to each other, but they knew what they were thinking. Well, the elves laughed and danced and played and did all the work. And then just before morning, they jumped on a moonbeam and vanished. Well, the husband and wife tumbled out of the closet, couldn't believe what they saw. Elves have been helping us. My goodness, we're so lucky. And then they thought, well, what can we do to help the elves or to thank them for all the help they've been giving us? And they thought and thought, and then they decided, since it was near Christmas, they would make them Christmas presents. And since this is in Germany, it was all snowy and cold outside, so they thought that the poor elves were naked, so they need some clothes to keep them warm. So the shoemaker sat down and sewed two tiny pairs of boots, and his wife sat down and sewed two tiny pairs of suits, a coat and pants, and then they both worked together, made some cakes and cookies, real tiny ones, and they wrapped it all up and put it on the workbench. And then they hid in the closet to watch. This was Christmas Eve, because they wanted to see what the elves would do. Night fell, darkness came, the hours went by, and in the distance they heard tiny voices laughing and singing, and sure enough, the two naked elves jumped through the window and started dancing. Then they stopped, because there were no tools, there were no leather, the shoemaker and his wife had cleared everything away, but there were all these tiny presents wrapped up very neatly. They ran to the presents, tore them open, and squealed with glee when they saw the cakes and cookies and shoes and coats, and they put on other clothes immediately, ate all the cookies and cakes, and danced and laughed. And then just before morning, they jumped out of the window on a moonbeam and vanished. Well, the shoemaker and his wife were delighted that the elves had appreciated the gifts and had put on the clothes and they fit perfectly, and so they had a wonderful Christmas. But the next night, and the night after that, and the night after that night, and in fact, never more, did the elves come back. That was the last time they saw the elves. But the shoemaker had studied the workmanship from their boots and shoes they made, so he now sat down to work and could make boots just as good and shoes just as wonderful as the elves, so that his reputation continued to prosper, his business kept doing well, so that he and his wife were quite content. And often they would sit outside their house looking at the woods, and if they, in the evening, and they often could imagine they heard the sound of laughing, tiny voices laughing, singing, and the sound of tiny boots tapping on the forest floor. And so they spent the rest of their days in happiness and contentment. Well, the story is quite remarkable. It starts off like a usual fairy tale with people in some terrible situation, and then magic appears that rescues them. And then something strange and disturbing happens. They do something very nice, which is to thank the elves, and the elves never come back. The magic disappears. The story is actually quite disturbing if you think about it. What makes it even worse is that similar stories come from all over the world. There's a uniform theme of people at midlife lose some magic help. Any thoughts or comments about this? When I came across the tale, I thought, oh, I don't like this story, I'll ignore it. Then came another one, oh, I don't like that one, I'll ignore it. But the pile got too big, so I just couldn't ignore it. I think if you reflect on it, it's actually very accurate that the elves in this story make a good symbol for, excuse me, there's a story about the frog in the storyteller's throat. But that's for another time. The elves make a good symbol for the magic of youth, or the innocence of youth, and the magic of childhood, which disappears in the middle years when you have to work, take care of children, pay the mortgage, and so on. But any thoughts or reactions to this story, where it grabbed you or disturbed you or your life? Yes?
Well, it seems that even when your intentions are good, if you see something that you're not supposed to see, there'll be a change.
I think that brings up two important points, that they were doing something good, that they were giving a gift. So you think, why should they lose the magic? They should be rewarded for that. And there are other stories that show people doing nasty things and losing the magic, but they're about evenly divided, people doing good things. And I think it emphasizes that it's a developmental issue that occurs here. The loss of magic is not punishment. It's not a moral issue, but a developmental one. And the second point you point out is that when you see something you're not supposed to, that's when the elves leave. And that's a theme that appears in other stories around the world. When you become conscious of this magic, then it leaves. And again, it's very accurate, because at midlife we become pretty conscious of things. It's the same story as Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge, the fruit of the tree of knowledge. They become conscious, and then they lose the magic of Eden, and they're exiled. And what do they have to do? They have to work for their money and food. But I think it's an insightful point in the story and other middle tales, that as we become more conscious, the magic goes away, or seems to go away. Yes?
Well, it seems that they don't entirely lose the magic, they assimilate the magic.
That's another excellent point, that the elves go away, but actually the shoemaker now has their magic, because he can do what they were used to do. The difference is that they seem to do it while they're doing somersaults and laughing and dancing, where he does it as work. But it's true that the magic is not lost, it's transformed. It's like the enthusiasm of youth becomes the skill of midlife and the experience of midlife. But there's still an element of, well, the elves are kind of nice when they're around, and why did they have to go away? Yes?
As you finish the story, I was thinking that you also
as a mentor?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good point, that they did were effectively the mentor for the shoemaker in teaching him how to do this work well. Once you've learned from the mentor, you don't need the mentor anymore, that he's assimilated the magic. The elks would also make a good symbol for children. And that was your point. And raising children, they're innocent people, run around naked, do things fun, and then they leave after a while.
Yeah, but they usually don't make shoes while they're there.
Unfortunately, they don't make shoes. They usually wear out shoes, right? Yes.
But I think the point of that is that, okay, children don't make shoes, but they are making magic in terms of their taking in life and assimilating it themselves to become themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the distance between the shoemaker and the elves is the same sort of distance between adults and children.
Mm. I think that's true, that the elves and the shoemaker is like the adults and children. And in fact, there's an intriguing point that the elves go away when the shoemaker and his wife give them something, and they switch from receiving the gifts from the elves to giving a gift to the elves. And if you think about it, that's a nice definition of midlife, when you shift from receiving things from parents or students to giving them to your children or students. And that's when the elves go away because they're shifted to a new stage of life. The story is very symbolic because it has the elves given the gift on Christmas Eve and Christmas. So, and they're naked elves, so they would be a good symbol of sort of a wild nature spirit or the pagan spirit. In German tradition, they would be pagan versus the civilized Christian tradition, which gives them clothes. And that's another hint of the difference between midlife and youth, that sort of the wild natural instincts and impulses have to be clothed and socialized so that we can get on in society. And it's when they give them clothes that the elves go away. Yes?
I felt kind of sad when they dressed up and ate the food. And, I mean, even though they still were laughing and giggling, but it just felt like a loss at that point of the story.
I think that's a good point. There's something sad when the elves put on the clothes and suppose, I guess, keep it. Yes, way in the back. Oh, yes. Yes.
Rapping in the forest. And to me, that's very significant that what is necessary to be learned from the subconscious, from the child, from the inner magic, isn't completely gone. It simply has, simply doesn't play the part of teaching at all.
Yes. That's a good point, that the elves don't disappear. It's sort of like they're a little more distant. And elder tales, the stories about the last sort of life, reveal that the elves come back, fortunately.
Oh.
A word of hope. Yes.
You know, that point makes you think that if you could find a little time between making shoes to go for a little walk in the woods, you might actually run into the elves.
That's a good point, that if it went for a walk, they might find the elves. It's another important point that the elves appeared because the shoemaker left his work behind and went home. Instead of worrying and obsessing and being a workaholic and thinking, well, how can he get out of this predicament, he put everything aside and went home. And that's a good symbol where the elves would be the unconscious creativity, where you sleep on a problem and then the elves come up and give you the solution. But if you stay up all night, the elves will never appear. So the story is actually quite profound and has many levels of meaning. Yes?
I think that the a story seems to stress more than the loss of the innocence and spontaneity of the elf, the gaining and the finding of the elf, because there were no elves at the beginning of the story. And the shoemaker and his wife were presumably perfectly respectable and well-dressed people, and suddenly the elves come into their
The point was that overall the story actually is an increase in magic, because before there were no elves, and now the elves appear and they leave something behind the skill of the shoemaker, plus their intriguing presence off in the forest. Now there's a... if we take the elves as a symbol of creativity, the story has another level of meaning, where which relates to how creativity changes at midlife. Elliot Jacques, a psychoanalyst, did a study of the biographies of major creative figures like Mozart, Beethoven, Shakespeare, and so on. And he found a fairly common pattern. In youth, they had a type of creativity that he called hot from the fire, where a product appeared full-blown in the composer or writer's mind. Just like Mozart apparently heard his compositions and just transcribed them. It appeared full-blown. Then around 40 or somewhere around there in the midlife period, there's a crisis. A lot of the creative people die then, like Mozart. The others who don't die just sort of stop creating. But then after that, after the crisis, they come up with a new kind of creativity, which Jacques called sculpted creativity. And by this he meant that you come up with an inspiration and then you fiddle with it, and then you fiddle with it, and you rewrite, and you rewrite, and you revise, and you revise, and you finally get something that you're satisfied with. So it no longer springs full-blown, but it's something that you have to work and work. And I think hot from the fire is the elves. They come at night, and you arrive in the morning, and there it is, finished product. And the shoemaker working it by himself is a sculpted creativity. And that's a sobering, or, well, I guess it's a statement of fact, but creativity does have its own phases in, over the life cycle. Yes.
Well, the elves putting on the clothes indicate it's gone from the instinctual level and integrated into the ego. Mm.
The comment was the elves putting on the clothes means that something from the instinctual or unconscious level has been assimilated into the ego or consciousness. And I think when that happens, something of a sparkle goes out, although the magic isn't lost. Now, the importance of work is emphasized ad nauseum in these stories. And it brings up an important story in the Grimm's Tale, which is very insightful and very hilarious, about the ages of man. I can never resist telling it because it's so perceptive and so funny. And the story goes like this. When God created the world, he gave all species of animals the same lifespan, which is 30 years. Well, the donkey came up to God and said, God, I realize I'm destined to be a beast of burden, so I don't want to live 30 years and have to carry loads back and forth and be beaten and harried and whipped. Please take some years back. So God took 18 years back. Then the dog came by and said, oh my God, 30 years is much too long. My eyesight will be poor, my teeth will fall out, my legs will be tired. All I will be able to do at 30 years would be lie by the fire and growl and want to sleep. So please take some years back. So God took a dozen years back. Then the monkey came by and said, oh my gosh, 30 years is much too long. I'll have arthritis in my shoulder from swinging in the trees. I'll be nearsighted and I'll crash into stuff. Oh God, please take some years back. So God took 10 years back. Then guess who came by but humanity. And humanity said, 30 years? That's not enough. We'll just be starting to live then. We want more. And God said, well, I gave everybody the same amount. Oh, but I do have some extra years here in my bed. Here, you can have the 18 years from the donkey. And humanity, man and women, that's 30 plus 18, that's 48. That's still not enough. We want more years. God wasn't too pleased about this, but he had extra years, so he gave the 12 years from the dog to humanity. Humanity counted at 48 and at 60. That's still not enough. I want some more. So God gave 10 years from the monkey. And then humanity went away. There were no more years to give away. And that is the reason the story says we're all basically healthy and happy the first 30 years, because that's the normal span of life. Then come the donkey years. When we're harried, we carry burdens, we're beaten and wet, nobody appreciates us. Then come the dog years, when all you want to do is lie by the fireplace and sleep. But finally, come the monkey years, when you can do whatever you want and not care what people think. Well, the shoemaker and the elves emphasizes the theme of work, but it's also the theme of the magic changing appears in many other stories. One of which would be the story of Parsifal and the Holy Grail, where if you recall, Parsifal was wandering around one day and then stumbled upon the castle of the Holy Grail, beheld the grail itself, but didn't know what he was supposed to do, and so he was kicked out of the castle. That was when he was a young man. And then he was called at midlife to search again for the castle. He had this initial contact with the magic and then lost it during the middle years and then had to go find it again. The same theme appears for women with the story of Psyche and Amour, when she marries Amour, but doesn't know who he is. And then when she lights the lantern and sees who he is, he leaves her. She becomes conscious of who he is and she loses the magic and then has to go on this long journey to reclaim him. So the theme in the apparently simple story of the elves and the shoemaker reverberates throughout the mythology. Any other comments or questions or catcalls or criticism? Yes, right in the back.
Just the observation that the elves did not appear until the shoemaker was down to his last piece of leather.
Yes.
And the creativity often finds waits for a moment of
experiment. I think that's a good point. He was down to his last bit of hope, but he didn't give up. He sat down and carefully did his work. It's like with creativity, you have to do the work of incubating the idea before the solution will pop up at night. Or shall I go on to another story? Okay. This will move us to a little further into midlife and has to do with husbands and wives again. This story comes from Russia and is called The Lute Player. Once upon a time, far away, there lived a great king and queen. The king was extremely powerful, his land was at peace, and his wife was there, he was happy with his wife, but he was bored with life. He wanted some excitement. So he told his wife, the queen, that he had decided he would start a war, a famous midlife occupation for men. And he decided to do this because he had heard news of an evil heathen lord far away who was persecuting his people. So the king decided to free that foreign land of their evil lord, and he assembled his army and navy and prepared to leave. The queen thought this was not a good idea, but would the king listen to the queen? No, he was the king. So he went off with his army and navy and sailed away. Well, after a long time, they arrived at the foreign country, they landed, and wherever the king's troops went, they conquered and beat everybody. So they were wonderful. I mean, they were happy and victorious. They thought, this is a lot of fun. But the heathen lord had massed his troops elsewhere, secretly, and suddenly they attacked the king's army, defeated the king's army, captured the king and all his generals, and threw them in the dungeon. And from that day on, the heathen lord made the king work like a slave in the fields, pulling plows as if he were an ox. Well, the king was horrified, but there was nothing he could do. It took him 3 years to befriend a guard who was willing to smuggle a letter out from the king to a merchant who then took it to a sailor who took it across the sea, took it to here and there, and finally got to the queen. The queen, of course, was frantic with worry because she had no news from her husband for 3 years. And when she got the letter, she was even more upset. In the letter, the king said, "I've been captured and thrown in a dungeon. Sell everything in the kingdom, bring the money for ransom, and free me." The queen was horrified to find that this had happened to her husband, but then she started thinking, this is not a good idea. If I sell everything and go to this heathen lord, he'll just make me one of his concubines and keep the money. And if I send somebody else, they'll probably just run away with the money. What am I to do? My husband is stuck in this dungeon. I told him not to go anyway. She thought and thought, and then she had an idea. She went into her room, she took off her royal robes, she put on the outfit of a young man, cut off her beautiful long hair so she looked like a young man, then picked up a lute, and then secretly left the palace, and then went outside and played her lute. She acted as a minstrel, and she traded songs and music for passage on ships and food until she finally made her way gradually through the country of the evil heathen lord. nobody guessed her disguise because she was so good at it, and she was also a very accomplished musician. She found the castle of the heathen lord, sat outside, and started playing her lute and singing. And her music was so beautiful that even the birds stopped to hear. Well, the heathen lord heard her music, ordered the young man, he thought it was a young man, to come in and ask this new minstrel to play for him. And the heathen lord said, "Stay with me for 3 days and play your magical music, and at that time I'll give you whatever your heart desires, if it's in my power." So the queen agreed, and she stayed for 3 days, playing songs of war and love and magic and adventure and misfortune, and the heathen lord was so entranced he even forgot to eat. But after 3 days, the queen stood up and said, "My lord, I must leave. I am a wanderer. My home is a road." And the heathen lord said, "Well, I wish you could stay with me forever, but I gave you my word that you could go after 3 days, and I promised you whatever you desire. So name your reward, and I will grant it." And the queen said, "Oh, I'm just a minstrel. I really don't need anything. I can't carry anything heavy or valuable. But, you know, sometimes it gets lonely wandering the road by myself. What I think I want is a companion, and I'll just take someone from your dungeon, somebody you won't mind missing." And the heathen lord agreed to this, so they both went down in the dungeon, and the queen immediately recognized her husband, even though he was emaciated. For his part, he didn't recognize his wife, because she was disguised. So the wife said, "Oh, I'll just take that criminal." And the heathen lord released the king, and the two of them left and traveled. Well, the queen earned passage and food for both of them by playing her music, but she never once revealed her identity to the king, and the king never once guessed who she was, until they finally came to their land, and the king said, "I am the king of this country. Come with me to my palace, and I'll reward you greatly." And the queen said, "Oh, I don't need any reward. Go with God's blessing." So the two of them parted, and the king hurried to the palace. Now the queen knew a shortcut, so she got there first. She went to her room, put on her royal robes again, and then went out to greet the king. As soon as the king appeared, all the people started cheering, the ministers ran out, everybody was delighted that the king was safe and home again. But when the queen appeared, the king turned his back to her and said, "Who is this faithless woman who left me to rot in prison?" And the ministers explained that she had vanished as soon as she had gotten the letter. He refused to talk to her. So she went back in her room, put on the minstrel's clothes over her royal robes, picked up her lute, went outside, and started playing. The king immediately ran outside and said, "This is the man who saved my life. Now you cannot refuse me. Name what you desire, and I will grant it." And the queen shook off her minstrel's robe, revealed herself as the queen, and said, "I only desire you." The king was speechless. He knelt at her feet and begged her forgiveness for doubting her. And then the two of them returned hand in hand to the palace, where the king ordered a double celebration, once for his rescue and the second time for his wife's great wisdom and courage. And so the two of them lived in happiness, contentment, and pacifism the rest of their days. Well, what do you make about this story? It's a very striking story, but the tale, similar stories come from around the world, and it basically reverses the Sleeping Beauty or Cinderella story, where the gallant prince rescues the helpless princess. In Middle Tales, it's the gallant queen rescuing the helpless king, and it comes from tales around the world. Any thoughts about that?
Well,
yes.
It kind of makes you think of some of the stuff that Jung talks about the first part of life being really outer directed and really associated with the masculine principle, and that the task of midlife, I think he kind of talks about it as when you reach the top of the mountain and you see that there's nowhere to go but down, that there's a reconciliation with the opposite at that time,
yes.
Knowing that you need to integrate in order to proceed the rest of the way.
Uh-huh.
And so this sounds like a real reconciliation with the feminine on the part of the king.
I think that's an excellent point. In fact, this story is so Jungian. I mean, I thought, did a Jungian write this? But it comes from an old collection. Because Jung was one of the first to point out the role reversals that occur at midlife, where men who are raised traditionally with the heroic masculine attitude have to come to terms with their feminine side, with intuition, feeling, vulnerability, the importance of relationships. And that's what this king has to do. And women, conversely, who are brought up in a traditional way, have to come to terms with their aggressive, autonomous, independent, courageous, adventurous side, which is exactly what this queen does. And they come together at the end as a reconciliation or a balance between masculine and feminine. And the story shows it happening with relative ease. In real life, it's often very difficult, especially for married couples, where the roles reversals can be very tumultuous. But again, this is a fairy tale. Yes?
The detail that's really appealing is that she doesn't reveal herself to the king and travels back with him in disguise.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's a detail that appears in stories around the world, where in midlife, the wife, often a queen, plays another role to rescue the husband. The husband doesn't recognize her. And I think they underscore several important points. One is that that's a task for men at midlife to learn about interpersonal things, that men traditionally focus on roles and hierarchy rather than a person, and that he has to learn to see through the role to the person underneath. He has to come to terms with this more feminine related side or eros side, which is undeveloped for him. And the queen or the wife doesn't reveal herself because she needs to give the king time to develop. In this story, it's clear that the queen has developed more quickly than the king. She's gone on this very adventurous, heroic journey, integrated her masculine side, where the king is still fumbling around in dungeon. So she doesn't try to force him to develop. She's wise enough to wait until he's ready for it, which is a very important point for husbands and wives. There's one last point, though, and that's the theme of men being unconscious, unaware, or literally asleep at midlife. And it's the function of the woman to wake up the king or reveal the secret. It's the reverse of Sleeping Beauty.
You know, in other fairy tales where he actually becomes, he has that amnesia that occurs when she'll say to him, if you, you know, do this certain thing, you'll forget all about it.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And he does, and then he has to be reawakened.
Yes. There's a theme that in Middle Tales, it shows the man asleep and the woman has to wake him up. And I think feminists will make a great deal of this, that it's true in patriarchal society, men get all the goodies, so they really don't have incentive to think about things. So women have to wake men up at midlife. Yes?
I respond to the depression of being in the dungeon.
Yes.
And if you look at the counter tale where the princess was in the blues before the Prince Charming comes, and then he's expecting a betrayal.
Yes, yes.
And the big surprise is that she's a hero.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's really the cheerful part. Because many times the betrayal is true. You know? Mm-hmm. So in this fairy tale, it's a happy ending.
It's an important point was that the king expected the queen to betray him when she didn't apparently appear. And in true life, often it happens that the queen might marry somebody else.
You hinted on that in your story, like this was not a wise idea.
Yes.
I thought she was going to stay
there.
Yes. But I think you get out of the dungeon through art, through music. And I think for some men I know that's how they go on to the next stage.
Yes. That's an excellent point that the king gets out of the dungeon through art, through the queen's music. And I think you can interpret the story two ways here. One is that the queen could represent the king's anima, his feminine side, which has to come rescue him at midlife. And it does so through music or art. As you pointed out, often men literally at midlife become interested in art, start painting like Winston Churchill or other men. And that's how they reclaim their feminine emotional eros side. You could also interpret it literally as the king and queen, and that the queen has to go on this masculine heroic adventure to rescue the king, but she doesn't use the usual warrior way. She uses music. So if she becomes a hero, it's a very uniquely feminine approach, which dispenses with force or coercion.
But she also uses trickery.
Yes.
Surprise.
Yes. And that's another important point. It's very wise for her to do that, because if she went as a queen, she could just be taken as a concubine. She has to be disguised. And again, presumably because it wouldn't be safe for a woman to travel on her own. Yes. The point was the queen remains steadfast and loyal to the king. And this is a fairy tale.
I'm not quite sure what I want to do with that perspective, but to stay a little more Jungian about it rather than just the mundane world, I was beginning to try and play with it in terms of how it's an opportunity for the man to learn how much the anima, excuse me, is really a part of himself. Mm. She is not going to be there.
Yes.
Uh-huh. No matter what you get.
I think that's a good point. And again, you can interpret the story two ways, intrapsychically, where the queen is the anima who won't desert the king, or as a story between two people. Other stories that we'll cover in the workshop tomorrow pose the question for women very clearly. Do they stick with this husband, or do they get rid of him? In this case, the queen sticks with him. In other cases, the woman has to kill off this evil husband who's trying to kill her or something. But there is that choice. Yes?
I'm wondering if there isn't a third way to look at it, which is that this could be an anima.
Yes.
It's a story about a woman's journey of discovering the masculine. Mm-hmm. And maybe that would account for some of the steadfastness of the woman. Mm-hmm. What she needs to do in order to reclaim her own man.
Yes, that's an excellent point, that you can interpret the story as about a woman where the king is the animus. And as often happens when the animus first breaks out, it goes overboard a little bit and then starts this huge war and then gets caught and then all sorts of problems. And she has to go rescue the animus and integrate the animus' aggressive energy in a uniquely feminine way through musical art and cleverness. And not, she doesn't become a warrior queen. But I think you're right, it could be interpreted that way. Yes?
There's another thing that comes up for me in this type of story. Often there's a question of the outcome, of course, and a lot of it hinges on how the king will behave, and you always get to wonder, does he then do something unforgivable? Mm-hmm. Which is a pattern, I think, in a lot of these stories. So it's very interesting that, except for being ignorant, he didn't, but often it's a transgression.
Kingdom. Yeah, the story doesn't specify if it was the king was king through his own way or through the wife. But it's an important point that the king reforms at the end. That whatever his assumption that the queen wasn't going to rescue him, he begs her forgiveness. And that's a crucial theme in stories about midlife, that the people who are wrong or nasty or villainous reform. And it's very reassuring at midlife. And if you think about it, stories about young people, the villain or nasty, obnoxious people are just killed off. There's no forgiveness or no reformation. And that reflects the psychology of youth, where you're either right or you're wrong. And usually it means everybody else is wrong, and I, the young person, am not. At midlife, you stop all that projection and you realize, hey, I am wrong, or I could be wrong, and have to make amends. It's a theme that appears around the world of self-reformation and self-confrontation. Yes?
What strikes me is that that's a dangerous point when the man is going to be reintegrated into his position of authority, because, as he points out, his pride could cause him to make a fatal error, his dignity, which is so important to a man off in the middle life. There's something very delicate about the way she segues him back into it. He gets to be a hero's return before he finds out he saved her. So he saves face.
Yeah, she's very skillful at getting the king back in. And again, underscoring the theme of how she is quite wise. And it's a uniquely feminine approach. That, again, it's not the typical warrior stuff. Now, it's significant that the protagonists are king and queen. And it turns out middle tales often have their protagonists are king and queen. They're royal. And I think the symbolism is very literal. That as the philosopher Ortega y Gasset said, the middle-aged generation is the age in charge of society. They run families, they run corporations, run institutions, and so they're basically king and queens. So the problem is different from the shoemaker who's down on his luck. these are the issues of people at the peak of power. And they show that the issues of that for men at the peak of power is learning humility. They're thrown down and have to learn the other side. And usually for women, it's a matter of reclaiming their authentic power or their inner power. Yes, way in the back.
I was struck by an earlier part of the tale where he goes in a valiant battle against evil and looked at it psychically, and evil comes around from the side and downs him and captures him, and he's captured for some period of time. And just the whole dynamic of, at the end of youth and moving into middle age, a last cling to the ideal, and then being captured by your own shadow, and held captive by it, and then the appearance of the feminine music, purity, that beguiles the evil or dissipates it, and they're clean.
Yes. I think it brings up several important points. The king goes off on this idealistic crusade to vanquish the villain. It's a typical youth story of, they're evil, I'm not, I'm the good guy. Surprise, the evil guy wins here. the shadow will not be conquered. In youth, the evil side is conquered. But at midlife, it's not. You can't conquer the shadow at midlife. And actually, in adolescent horror stories, which appeal to adolescents, have the same theme usually. There's some horrible monster or alien or blob or something that attacks the teenagers, and then they finally vanquish it. Except it isn't killed, it sort of goes underground, and you know it will appear in a sequel, which is midlife.
you talked about developmental stages, and it almost seems like this is an Orpheus for the Middle Ages, or for the Middle Ages.
Yes.
Orpheus is in adolescence, and kind of roles are reversed, but in each... the flaw has to do with the male either looking when he's not supposed to or not looking when he should be.
Uh-huh. That's a very good analogy, that this is an Orpheus story, but unlike the original Orpheus, who looked and then lost his wife, the queen carries it off, presumably because she's more mature.
She doesn't let herself be seen.
Yes. Uh-huh. So it's a role reversal, but very neatly done. Yes?
Just 2 points. It seems that when the king sends the message for the queen, he is doing it in accordance with the old attitude.
Yes.
Of kind of buying things, and the queen, if she takes it subjectively as the anima of the king, knows a great deal more about how to approach it. I'd also like to mention that this has been the general theme has been the subject of concern for great creators such as Beethoven. His one opera, Fidelio, is entirely engrossed in this theme of the woman going down to a dungeon dressed as a man in order to save her husband. And it's not only a question that Beethoven took that as a theme for an opera, but he struggled over it. He worked it again and again and again. It was the most difficult thing that he ever worked through creatively. So that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And you find this theme in a sense also in a certain Shakespeare play, where the woman takes the role of the man in order to achieve certain things. Mm-hmm.
The point was that the theme of the wife rescuing the husband in midlife appears in Beethoven's opera Fidelio and some Shakespeare plays. And it's an archetypal theme. And actually, if you think about it, it's surprising that it emerges in a patriarchal culture. This story is basically subversive because it's throwing down the king and making the queen rescue him. And it makes you wonder how it could survive. And if the same theme comes from stories around the world. And I think there are several reasons for this. One is that fairy tales are not meant to be believed, as I mentioned, so unconscious stuff can come up when you suspend belief. And if the priest or imam or whatever catches you with a subversive story and says, that's heresy, you can say, oh, what are you getting upset about? It's just a fairy tale. And lastly, these folk tales are often told informally in private settings and also after a lot of drinking, like at feasts, which also encourage unconscious stuff to come up. So the fairy tales, in a way, preserve or bring up issues that society doesn't want to deal with consciously. They pop up and give us the picture of what needs to be taken care of. Way in the back.
I found it very interesting. The queen knew a shortcut back then. Mm. Somehow she carries it with her, or somehow wherever she goes, the kingdom, even she never leaves it, wherever she goes.
Maybe she's
within the kingdom, or wherever she goes, she carries it with her.
She certainly has an intimate knowledge of the kingdom, much more than the king does. And again, that's a feminine theme, that the king would follow the official avenues, where she would know the paths that the people really take. Yes?
This kind of condition, perhaps one could say, before the narrative begins, is one of boredom, status quo. Could one then say that this could be a catalyst for the whole action?
Yes. The point was that boredom was the initial situation, which acts as a catalyst to this development. In a way, hearing about the heathen lord sort of gets the king going. And again, it's accurate. Midlife, we often feel bored because you've mastered your career and you wonder what to do next. Yes?
Yeah, actually, the theme that seems consistent throughout is the theme of the male in midlife, of his sense of helplessness. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't seem to get it. So the first time he goes off to overcome that by waging war, which he loses, but he still hasn't realized how out of control he is. But in the dungeon, he tries to take charge of it by telling his wife how to rescue him.
Yes.
And still he misses it. Now he gets home, and she has rescued him, and he misses it a third time by trying to order her around. It's not until the very third time that it dawns on him how helpless he is in midlife, and he can then come to terms with his own humility. That seems a very consistent theme.
Yes. And what's remarkable is he does realize it. He doesn't keep going on this old king route routine. And again, that's the Reformation theme, that people do change at midlife. If you think about it, this story has no magic. It could actually occur.
It does.
And the real magic is... Yes.
To me, the role reversal is reminiscent of British pantomime, where the principal boy is always the girl, and the wicked witch is always a man. Mm. And there seems to be correlation there. And another thing that struck me was the reviling of the queen on his return was done in public, but the amends were made in private.
The comment was
a big banquet, though.
Yes, that was a celebration, but in making his amends to the queen, that was
Actually, that probably was done outside, because
yes.
He ran outside to meet the minstrel, and then she took off her minstrel's clothes.
Yeah. So that was done in public as well.
So it seems to be done in public. But your point that British mime often has role reversals, again, underscores the archetypal. That's part of the subversive nature of these stories, to stir things up. Now, one question that often comes up is, why is the queen so faithful to the king? Why does she pursue him? And if you think about it just as a couple, maybe you won't wonder about that, but we have to look at it also at a symbolic level, that the king is the patriarch, so he's a symbol of all society. And in a sense, by the queen pursuing him, she's actually pursuing a change not just in him as a person, but in society, presumably by accepting, recognizing her as an important person or as an equal, that there is an equal change in society. So I think it's a story not just of the queen going after her husband, but the queen going after society or patriarchal society. And that again appears in other stories where the ending results in a new order or a new society being formed. Way in the back.
I really like the part at the end where the queen bows down to the king.
Quite touching, isn't it? But it is a fairy tale. But it's also an archetypal theme, though, because in Dante's Divine Comedy, it starts off with him being lost at midlife, and then he has this descent into the inferno, and he's helped and guided along the way by Beatrice, the divine love of his. Yes?
Do you have any ideas about what it means that the king is willing to have his whole kingdom sold for his own ransom?
that seems not very kindling. And she figures out a way to do it that doesn't cost anything.
Mm. Yeah, the question is, why does a king do something so unkingly as, say, sell all the kingdom and come rescue me? He's very selfish at this point. He's thinking just egocentrically, because presumably he'd sell everybody down the river just to free himself. And the queen recognizes you can't do that. And as you point out, she comes up with a better solution.
There's some historical prototypes and some folklore around that when Richard the Lionheart was in the Crusades, Eleanor was supposed to disguise herself as a bee king and done some stuff to get him out. He was also perfectly willing to sell the
whole. Yes. The comment was that there is a historical parallel with Richard III and Eleanor. Richard I. Okay. Presumably this is an archetypal theme, though, because it appears around the world, and this one comes from Russia. Interesting enough, English stories don't have this particular story, as you'd expect based on history.
One of the child English and Scottish popular ballads.
Is about that, okay. Any last comments or questions? Yes.
I've just been thinking that if the story kind of went a different way at the end, you know, the players were still important. Like the masquerading queen could have been mistaken as another feminine figure, perhaps an outward figure. Mm. Could have even, you know, in the end, I think this is taking place inside one psyche.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that it doesn't have to be this external queen or something.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the players, who they are, is an interesting part of the fairy tale kind of squeeze.
Yes, because again, you can interpret intrapsychically, interpersonally, or socially.
Right. What I find is a lot of that anima is projected around in these figures mm-hmm. in the real world, but in my own journey, I found it to be an intrapsychic thing.
Mm-hmm. There's a story we'll cover in the workshop tomorrow that nicely distinguishes that the projection of the anima as intrapsychic versus interpersonal, and how men get confused and finally figure it out. So, yes?
I keep wondering about all the kings and men.
The story doesn't specify. That would be in Lute Player 2. Well, let me summarize the main points of this story, again emphasizing that these themes appear in tales around the world. We start off with husband and wife, man and woman, who are in charge. The man is then thrown down and forced to suffer, and in this way is forced to come to terms with his feminine side, with his vulnerable side, the importance of relationship. And conversely, the wife has to go out and be gallant, courageous, clever, heroic to rescue the king. So that finally there is a balance of masculine and feminine. And it's important that the king does reform at the end to acknowledge the queen's importance. And the queen insists on that. She just doesn't sort of say, oh, it's nothing that I rescued you. She makes sure that there is an egalitarian relationship at the end. And again, the stories appear around the world. There are other tales that show a different drama for men who are not raised in a traditional way. For example, men who are very nurturing, accommodating, and more feminine in youth. The stories show that they have to become aggressive and heroic at midlife. And conversely, for women who are powerful, their stories of ruling queens who are not married, they are thrown down and go through the same thing that the king goes here. So that the theme is a balance of whatever side you didn't deal with in youth, you deal with at midlife. If you were raised traditionally for a woman to be more nurturing, then you have to reclaim the heroic side. For men raised to be aggressive and heroic, you have to deal with the nurturing side. But if you're raised in a different way, then whatever you didn't deal with pops up. Why don't we take a 15-minute break now and then come back for more tales. We should explain for the workshop tomorrow, be continuing to tell more stories, different ones, looking in greater depth at the midlife process. In addition, I have several scripts so that people can volunteer to act out some fairy tales, which is usually a lot of fun. And lastly, there'll be some exercises in active imagination to help get you to write your own story, the fairy tale of your life. So that'll be in the workshop tomorrow. let me go on now to another middle tale. Excuse me. This one is called Destiny and brings up some more issues of midlife. I may have to tell you about that frog. And this story comes from Dalmatia, formerly part of Yugoslavia. Once upon a time, there were two brothers who lived together who inherited a farm from their parents who had died. The elder brother worked hard every day, toiling in the fields with the animals, while his younger brother stayed home, drank with his friends, had fun, and just enjoyed himself. This didn't sit right with the elder brother, so he finally told the younger brother, "Let's divide our inheritance. You take half, and I'll take half, and you work on your half, and I'll work on my half." And the younger brother said, "Oh, brother, why make this change? We both live happily. You have control of the farm, and everything is comfortable. Why make a change? It might make things worse." But the elder brother insisted, so they divided the farm, the fields, the flocks, and the younger brother had his half, and the older brother had his. Well, the younger brother continued to drink with his friends and have fun. He had the sheep taken care of by a shepherd, and he hired people to plow his fields and plant for him, and his farm prospered greatly. The older brother, meanwhile, worked really hard, but his barn burned down, a blight killed the wheat in his field, wolves ate all his sheep, until he had nothing left. He finally realized he had to go to his younger brother to ask for help, with hat in hand. So he put his pride away and went off for his younger brother's house. On the way there, he came across a beautiful woman sitting in a field surrounded by flocks of sheep, and she was spinning flax into gold. And the older brother said, "Good day, my lady. What are you doing?" And she said, "Oh, I'm spinning flax into gold." And then he said, "Well, whose sheep are you watching?" "Oh, they are your brother's, and this gold is for him." And the older brother said, "Well, and who are you?" "Well, I am your younger brother's luck." And the older brother said, "This explains a lot." But he was very smart, so he said, "Do I have a luck?" And the beautiful woman said, "Ah, alas, you do. But she is a wretched, miserable hag who lives in the forest there and takes away everything that you have." The older brother heard all this, thanked the lady, and went on his way to visit his younger brother. As soon as the younger brother saw him, he burst into tears, welcomed the older brother into the house, gave him shoes, clothes, food, and money, and said, told the older brother to stay with him and live with him. But the older brother said he had an errand to run, a mission to carry out, and so he left, went home, packed some belongings, and then went off to look for his luck. He looked and looked in the forest that his younger brother's luck had told him his luck lived in, until he finally came across a horrible, ugly crone sitting at the foot of a tree sleeping. When he came up, he woke her, and she looked at him and said, "It's lucky for you I was sleeping when you got all those new stuff from your younger brother, otherwise I would have destroyed them too." The older brother said, "Good day to you too. And who sent you to me?" And the lady said, "It was destiny. Why did destiny want me to suffer so much?" And the old woman shrugged and said, "Ask him, don't ask me." So the older brother went in search of destiny to demand an explanation. He searched all over the world, high and low, until he finally came to a hermit who said, "Ah, I know where destiny lives. He lives on top of the mountain right there. All you have to do is climb the mountain to get to his place. When you get there, do not speak until he speaks to you, and in the meantime, just do whatever he does." The older brother thanked the hermit for the advice, climbed the mountain, and found a wonderful palace there made of gold and jewels and silver. And there was Destiny sitting at this fabulous feast with pheasant, lobster, caviar, everything you could imagine. Well, he didn't speak to the older brother, so the poor man just did what he was told to do, which was to follow what Destiny did. So he sat at a corner of the table and started eating too. Well, after dinner, Destiny went into a beautiful bedroom and lay down in a wonderful bed and went to sleep. And the poor man followed in the bedroom and slept in a small corner. Then at midnight, a great voice and great shaking came throughout the house. And the voice said, "Destiny, destiny, all the souls that have come into the world today, ask for your gifts." The poor man was flabbergasted to hear this. And Destiny got up, went to a treasure chest that was made of gold and studded with jewels. He opened it, and he started throwing out gold and jewels right and left. And he said, "As I am today, so shall all the souls be born today. They shall have gold and jewels for all their lives." Then he closed the chest and went back to bed. And the poor man watched all this in silence and then went to sleep. The next morning he woke up and the palace was gone. In its place was a mansion, very fine, but not a palace. And for dinner that night they had a wonderful steak and potatoes and wonderful salad, but no pheasant or caviar. And then everything went as before. The Destiny did not speak to the older brother, but went to bed, and the older brother went to sleep in a corner of a smaller bedroom. And at night, the same voice shook the house and said, "Destiny, Destiny, all the souls that have come into the world ask for your gifts." So Destiny woke up, and he went to a huge silver chest. He opened it, and he threw out silver coins right and left. And then he went back, then he said, "As I am today, so shall all the souls be born today. They shall have silver all their lives." And he went back to sleep. Next morning, the poor man woke up and found that the mansion was gone and they were in an ordinary house. And that evening they had chicken and bread for dinner. And they went to sleep. The voice cried out again. Destiny woke up and opened a plain iron chest. And he threw out copper coins right and left. And he said, "As I am today, so shall all the souls born today be. They shall have copper coins all their lives." And he went to sleep. The next morning, the older brother woke up, and he found himself in a hovel with a hole in the roof and holes in the walls and the wind blowing through, and Destiny was outside digging for roots in the ground. And for dinner, all they had were boiled roots. That night, the voice shook the little hovel, crying out for Destiny's gifts. And Destiny opened a little sack this time and threw out pebbles and said, "As I am today, so shall all the souls born today be. They shall have pebbles all their lives." And then he went to sleep. Then the poor man woke up the next morning and he found himself in the wonderful palace once more, gold and jewels and a huge banquet. And as they were eating dinner, Destiny finally said, "My good man, you have been here and been very patient and quiet all this time. Now tell me, what brings you here?" And since he was now spoken to, the older brother spoke up and said, "Oh, I have come to ask you why you have sent this horrible wretch as my luck and this beautiful, wonderful woman to my brother." And Destiny said, "Oh, you have observed my life. Your brother was born on a day of gold and jewels, so he has gold and jewels no matter what he does. And you, my friend, unfortunately, were born in a day of pebbles and stones, and that's all you get." The older brother was horrified. "You mean no matter how much I work, nothing will happen? I can't ever change my fate?" And Destiny said, "No matter how much you work, but there is one way you can change your fate. And that is, your brother has a daughter named Eliza. If you marry her, you will have good fortune, because like her father, she was born on a day of gold and jewels. So whatever she does will turn out right. But you must remember something. If you marry her and enjoy her fortune, you must tell anybody who asks whose fortune it is that it is hers, not yours." Well, the older brother thanked Destiny, climbed down the mountain, and went back home. And he asked his brother if he could marry Eliza, the daughter. Now, this is a little strange for American customs, but this is in certain countries, cross-cousin marriages, this would be okay. So the younger brother agreed, and Eliza and the older brother married. And immediately, the older brother's fortune changed. His fields flourished, his flocks multiplied, everything turned wonderful. Well, one day, the older brother was working in his fields, and a stranger came by, admired the beautiful farm, the beautiful barns, the rich fields, and said, "My gosh, who does this farm belong to? It's so wonderful." And the older brother said, "Oh, it is mine." And immediately a fire broke out in the barn and started to spread through the wheat fields, and the stranger left. The older brother ran after the stranger and said, "Oh, excuse me, sir, I was mistaken. It's not mine, it's my wife's." And instantly the fire went out. So the older brother continued to tend the fields and tell anybody who came by that it was his wife's, so that he and his wife and his brother lived in happiness and contentment the rest of their days. Now, this is a disturbing story. It goes against the Protestant work ethic. Most of you are probably taught like me, if you work hard in youth, you'll be rewarded. This story says,
no way.
No way. Any thoughts or reactions about it?
Where does Eliza live?
That's the $20,000 question. Where is Eliza?
This is more predestination. The understanding is an idea that your life is predestined.
Yes, the point is that the story is based on the old concept of predestination, that our fate is sealed. And today we don't accept that, except in two areas, with luck, which happens for we don't know why, and also with genes, genetic disposition. Some people are just more intelligent or more beautiful than others. Some people live longer. Some people have a lot of diseases. So that's where it does reappear today. And I think the theme of the story is, and appears in other tales, is that midlife, we come to terms with things over which we do not have control. Youth, whether it's male or female, has a heroic, romantic vision that if you try hard enough or make enough effort or smart enough, it will work out. And this story and other middle tales say no, that there are things beyond our control. So there's a switch here from the heroic view of youth to what is best be called a tragic view, that in the classic Greek sense, that there are powers beyond us that control us, and we can only put up with it. The corollary of that, though, is youth with the heroic idea, the dark side of that is guilt, that if there's always something you can do to control it, then if something goes wrong, it's your fault. But with tragedy, it's a recognition that we're not at fault, that we were just vulnerable or playthings of the gods or of bad luck. So this introduces a darker element. Of course, the one thing that nobody can conquer is death. And that, of course, is a major issue at midlife.
But the one thing that's important is that with the resourcefulness and the patience of the brother, he searched to find out what was going on. He made an analysis of the situation and found out what was going on. And then he took steps, and he stuck to the rule. He made a little misstep, but he did.
I think that's a good point, that he persevered, he wanted to understand, and in general, he's the perfect candidate for analysis or therapy. He wanted to go to the root of the problem and ask destiny why this happened. And that's his redeeming feature, that he does want to know and understand. He's not willing to just resign and live with his brother.
He didn't waste the time flogging the luck either.
No, that's true. He didn't flog his bad luck or just be nasty to her. He went to the source.
Right.
Yes?
Well, I think he ran one of the risks of therapy or of a successful and creative work of inflation at the end, of thinking that it is my ego who is responsible for it, rather than the self or the unconscious. It's a very beautiful parable.
That's right. It's an excellent warning about inflation, saying, the ego, I did it, and then immediately the fire breaks out. Because in reality, it was Meliza or the anima, his anima or the feminine, that rescued him from this terrible situation. Yes?
I think it's interesting that in the beginning of it, when he's with his brother, actually he's fine.
Yes.
I mean, everything is working pretty well, except that he doesn't like the fact that he has to work so hard, and his brother doesn't have to work so hard. So that's the thing that kind of sets the whole process up, that he isn't willing, that he wants to kind of have something different. In a sense, he's fighting his fate right there. And then, of course, it ends up coming back where
That's a nice point that it starts off, it's sort of like Eden, except it's two brothers rather than husband and wife.
Yeah.
And the older brother wants to individuate. He wants to be different or he's on his own man, so he leaves and then he loses everything. But eventually he comes back and what he gets is insight on the way. Yes?
And you said that the older brother felt bad because he had to be doing all this work, but he probably didn't have to.
Yes.
The younger brother was working, everything worked out. The guy left, everything continued to work out. If he'd gone in and had a drink and told a couple stories with the boys, he could have been happy too.
That's true. He could have just relied on his brother. And that underscores that he is an admirable character that he wanted to know. And that's what he ended at the end, that he was still depending on somebody else, but he now had knowledge. Way at the back.
I also get the sense that the younger brother was also a type of an animal because it is the part of the self that is unrecognized. Mm. And it's sort of pre-individuation kind of state when things are going okay and then he starts to become dissatisfied with it so that he goes on a journey and separates and he has reunited.
I think that's a good point that the younger brother could be an animus figure for the older brother. This would go against the classical Jungian thought that men don't have an animus. Of course, post-Jungians are postulating that now. Yes?
It definitely illustrates the need to let go of an illusion of control.
Mm. Yes. He really has to lose the illusion of control. Yes.
That was similar to what I was thinking, which is this story and the last one. Humility is like a real major factor in the midlife tasks, realizing that sometimes you just have to accept aid and no longer have your own like heroic way.
Mm. The point was humility is an important task for people who are heroic or proud. The reverse shows people who are humble and don't take credit for things, their task is to start boasting a little bit. So the stories are very even-handed. Mm. Yes?
Well, this guy is not that noble. What does he want to do? He wants to be rich. He can't do it on his own, so he goes and finds out, what do I have to do? Marry this chick. He's not willing to accept the life that he's been given. He's not even willing to say, okay, well, I'll settle for silver or copper. Just like, what's the fastest way to get rich? Marry her. Fine. He goes over, can I have her? Fine. Now he's rich. There's not much nobility here. I think it's great, but it's practical.
Well, this illustrates a good point about traditional folk tales. It was to elicit moral discussions. Like, is this a good guy or is this a bad guy? The one redeeming feature, though, is that destiny told him to marry Meliza. I mean, destiny would presumably be a symbol of the self. Way in the back.
Does the idea of karma ever enter into any of these thought processes?
Depending on the story, the question is, does karma enter into these thought processes? For this particular story, there's no explicit mention of karma, although destiny would play that figure. Stories, of course, from India have karma and dharma in it a lot, so it depends on the cultural part. But the theme of coming up with something that you can't control is around the world. Yes?
This story was told just slightly differently. I could recognize it as a personal story.
Yes.
He mastered everything, but he was still unsuccessful. Because he was doing everything in service to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And until he found the queen to be of service to, he hadn't solved it. Mm-hmm. So by being of service to the girl that he married and saying it's all for her, or it's her stuff, then he was successful. Mm-hmm. It's a slightly different way of telling the story.
Yes, the point was that the story is similar to the story of Parsifal, where the older brother really is bad straits because he's basically seeking something for himself, but when he finally recognizes he has to serve Meliza, then things are okay. The encounter with destiny is also equivalent to the encounter in the Grail Castle, and here he must keep silent. So it's the reverse of Parsifal, where he's supposed to talk, but the similarity is meeting a mysterious, powerful figure in a sacred place. Yes?
I think that the idea of it being a therapeutic parable, which is that, he comes to see, he goes to seek out how to change his life, and he's told, well, really, there's nothing you can do, you just have to accept your life, which is often what people are told, and then he'll be all right. Except there's a wrinkle that's added here, which is he can make that transformation, and so there's something in that, that marriage, that is really important, because that's what the transformation is.
And he doesn't change his fate, but kind of hooks himself to somebody else's fate and sort of reaches out, recognizes he can't do it just himself. The way I sort of like to look at it, it's like he's surfing on karma. Destiny tells him how he can manipulate karma so that he could get a happy ending.
But there's something more than that, something still deeper about himself that he's finding, that she represents some part of himself that he needs to discover. Do you have any idea what that would be? She represents inside of him?
Well, I think you could look at it as if he's the ego, then she'd be the anima, and Destiny would be the self. And so he'd be recognizing that he thought he was in charge, but he really isn't. I mean, even the anima is more powerful than he is.
Yes. I see it as a model for politicians. They look like they're serving themselves, you know, a little man. Mm. They look like they're serving the public good, and they get power. And it's the same story. Mm.
Yes.
Well, he sought knowledge, and then was revealed to him, and that knowledge was that he didn't have control over much. But also, what was revealed to him was truth. And what he did with that truth, he didn't have control over.
The knowledge did give him some power over destiny.
As soon as he told truth or not told truth, there was some.
Yes. That's right. He had control over whether to be honest or not, or authentic. Yes.
The two things seem interesting, different than the other sort of fairy tale. One is that he met the woman stealing, and he didn't try to steal her or take her, and he also didn't change his brother. And then, of course, also he married Eliza, it's not because she's beautiful or he loves her, but because he compliments. She has something. She was born with something. He didn't have a good compliment.
Yeah, in many ways he is admirable. He's not envious of his younger brother. In stories about young people, that's typically, of course, the younger brother has the stuff and the older brother tries to kill him off. And here he presumably has resolved some of this and he goes on to other issues. Way in the back. Yes, I think that's a good point, that the horrible luck represents a negative anima, and in some ways could represent a negative mother complex, because the marriage to Eliza is almost incestuous, but in American law it would be, so bringing up the Oedipal issue. But of course, again, in Arabic tradition, this would be okay. Yes?
Yeah, that's just what I was thinking about, is that not necessarily so much an anima, but that this is something that he was born with.
Last few comments, back.
One thing you haven't mentioned that seems to be hinted at with the older brother is that the he may be getting worn out, and our bodies change. That's another thing I have to comment. Do you have any comments on that?
Surprisingly enough, fairy tales don't address bodily issues very much. They do address illness at midlife, and the theme of healing becomes very prominent. Interesting enough, elder tales about last sort of life don't have much illness or bodily functions, probably because in historic times, if you lived that long, you were pretty healthy. Another thing that the middle tales don't address are children. I was surprised to find an absence of children, and it was very puzzling. So that parents normally do think about their children so that their dreams and fairy tales don't have to bring them up.
Well, and also we have children so much later now. In middle midwife.
Yes,
people.
That's true.
Previously, the children were more gone.
That's right. That's a good point. Midlife before would be post-parental, historically.
We need to change the stories a little now, if we have children later. Mm.
Comment?
Well, I wanted to know about the hermit, in that it was the key to approach.
Yes.
And my sense is that he had to experience and be with the source, but that the hermit already knew, already had information, that he, and maybe even the bad luck had the information, but he had to be with the source.
I think that's a good point. The comment was that the hermit is intriguing, and that it seems like the older brother had to be with destiny to see this cycle of fortune, and that maybe the hermit knew it, but if he just told the older brother, it wouldn't have been the same, that the older brother had to go through it. And again, it's a good analogy with therapy, that you'd have to go through the struggling, and if you just tell someone the answer, it doesn't help. Yes?
There may also be something about the universal quality of the firstborn, being more in the clutches of control issues.
Yes. And that's a good point. And the youngest child gets all the ease. The oldest child having gone through all the issues with the parents. One last question.
Yes, well, I referred to Fidelio before. There's an opera here based on a fairy tale, The Magic Flute, which has many aspects that are very similar, but I'm thinking particularly of Papageno, who is the unlucky companion of Tamino, who meets the anima first in the form of an old hag, and then she is transformed into his Papageno, but only after the two of them go through the trial of the fire and water. So there's really a parallel.
Of redeeming what appears to be ugly.
That's right. But the specific form of the unlucky man, a younger man, perhaps in this case, finding the anima in the form of a hag, but patiently, or fairly patiently, accepting, going through it, and then she is transformed.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me summarize some of the points from this story, Destiny. It basically is showing how an ugly issue rears its head in midlife, the issue of things we can't control, whether it's destiny, luck, bad luck, good luck, or fortune, or other elements of illness or death, and coming to terms with the more tragic side of life, giving up the heroic romantic fantasies, and in a way sort of the unconscious omnipotence of youth, and coming to terms with what we can't do. As someone pointed out, at midlife you reach the peak and then you see that it goes downhill from them. It's a matter of limits. Bernice Newgarten, a gerontologist, made a comment that midlife is when you stop thinking in your age as years from birth, but now it's years remaining. And that's a very good way to put it, that the perspective is now switched. What I thought I'd do for the last story would be to tell you an elder tale, to show you the difference between middle tales and elder tales, and to give you some reassurance after this disturbing message from Destiny. And the genre again shifts dramatically. Now, elder tales are defined as fairy tales with a protagonist who's specifically called old. But now, stories don't give a chronological age very often, but looking at certain clues, it appears that they mean old as anybody over 40 or 50. But again, historically, if you survive that long, you're really old and really lucky, because the average lifespan in the Roman Empire was about 18 or so. Well, this story is called Fortune and the Woodcutter. Once upon a time, there lived an old man and his wife, an old woman. He earned his living by cutting wood in the forest and had done so all his life, chopping wood, carrying it on his mules, taking it to the village and selling it for income. No matter how hard he worked, he couldn't get ahead. Times were tough, and everything he earned, he would spend. Well, he and his wife had three sons, and they rejoiced, and the three sons grew up and chopped wood with their father, and they chopped three times as much wood as their father, so he earned three times as much money. Unfortunately, they also ate three times as much food, so the poor man was no better off than before. Well, one by one, the sons left home because they realized they weren't going to find their fortune with their father, so the old man and his wife were left alone in their old age. Well, one day, the old man woke up, He got out of bed to go to work, to saddle his mules, take them to the forest, when he stopped. Then he got back in bed and went to sleep. His wife came rushing up. "Husband, do you feel ill? Why are you not going to work?" And the husband said, "Oh, I've decided I've run after fortune long enough, and I refuse to work for her anymore. If she's going to come, she's got to come looking for us." "What are you talking about?" the wife said. "If you don't chop wood, you don't sell wood, we don't have money. We don't have money, we don't have food. We're going to starve." But no matter what she said, he refused to get out of bed and work. Well, the next morning, the sun rose, as it usually does. He got up, he awoke, smiled as he never did before, turned over and went back to bed. And his wife came rushing up. "Husband, husband, this is enough. This is the second day. You must go to work. We don't have any food left. We don't have any money left. What are you doing? Are you sick? Should I call a doctor, a priest, a therapist? What?" Husband said, "If I've told you 1,000 times, I've told you 1,000,000 times, I refuse to run after fortune anymore. She has to come looking for us. I won't work anymore." Oh, the wife was really distraught. Well, the next day, the sun rose, the husband got up, smiled, went back to bed. The wife came rushing up. "Husband, husband, a stranger has come by, and he's seen that your two mules you're not using, so he wondered if he could borrow them." The man thought and said, "Oh, well, that isn't really work." So he went downstairs, negotiated with the stranger, and said the stranger could take the mules just as long as he gave them water and food, didn't beat them, and brought them back safely. The stranger agreed and left. Now, he was no ordinary man, but an evil necromancer. With his black arts, he had found the location of a great treasure in the forest. So he went straight there, dug up all the gold and jewels, loaded it on the mules, and then was about to go to his house when he heard noise in the forest. And he looked, and he saw the king's army marching by. And he became frightened. If they saw him with the treasure, they'd ask how he knew it was there. One question would lead to the other. They'd realize he was an evil magician and burn him at the stake. So he quickly ran and hid in the woods. Well, the army marched by without noticing anything, as armies usually do. So, and as for the necromancer, he had never been in the woods before, and so he was never seen from again. He was lost. Well, the two mules stood there all day waiting for someone to take them home, and all night too. And finally they realized, well, nobody was going to take them home, so they had to go home themselves. So they followed the trails they knew from years of working with the old woodcutter and went to his house and started braying loudly just as dawn broke. They wanted somebody to take off the load and give them food and water. The wife woke up, looked out the window, ran down, tried to take the bags off, and then could lift them, it was so heavy. So she ran upstairs to her husband and said, "Husband, husband, come down, come down. The mules have come back and they have something so heavy it looks like it's going to break their backs. You have to take it off." And the husband said, "If I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, I'm not working anymore." The wife ran downstairs, she didn't know what to do. She went to the kitchen, grabbed a knife, and slashed the bags to let whatever in it out so she could take the bags off. And imagine her astonishment when gold and jewels poured out. "Gold, jewels," she exclaimed. In an instant, her husband was downstairs. They both stared at all the gold and jewels pouring from the bags, and then they grabbed each other and danced, because fortune had indeed come to the old woodcutter and his wife. Well, any thoughts about this story? The woman was smart again. Yeah, she was very clever about how to get the bags off. But the story is very nice because it shows how magic returns in the elder years, in elder tales, that the donkey years aren't just work. And you might think that the story is just wish fulfillment, like a poor person dreaming of winning the lottery. But one detail in the story emphasizes this is not so. It's that the mules bring back the treasure because they knew the path from years of working with the old man. So that the return of the treasure is actually a return on years of his work. His donkey years has finally brought the magic back. So it's not wish fulfillment. It's actually the story of a successful IRA plan. It's also psychologically accurate because the man basically retires, and then there's all this trouble at home because he's underfoot all the time.
Yes.
Any other thoughts or comments? Yes.
I really like the man's perseverance in his decision. Mm. It's like knowing when it's time in your life to stop and do something different. Mm-hmm.
And it takes courage for him to stop and not go back to work, even when there's no food. It's either crazy or wise. And he certainly has a faith that something will have to happen. But it takes a lot of courage for him to do that. Yes, way in the back.
What he turns his back on is material sustenance. Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's an excellent point. In this story, he gets a material reward, but other elder tales make clear that that's not the real reward, it's a spiritual reward. And I'll be mentioning a few elder tales tomorrow that have that theme, that it's a spiritual task is central, not material.
It's what the necromancer couldn't have.
Yes, because he was an evil person. Yes.
But you can't say that the old man's decision to his bed was a wise decision. I mean, there was nothing smart about doing that.
That's a good point, that the old man's decision not to go to work doesn't seem wise, it seems actually crazy. But that's a theme that comes up in elder tales, that the elder has to do something that seems crazy, and then they discover the deeper wisdom behind it. And that it's that crazy act that brings the magic back. Well, one more question. Yes?
Yeah, I wanted to point out that the old man doesn't just turn his back on material demand or need, but also on his wife's anxiety. Mm-hmm. That kind of pestering, worrying, that in little work you won't get ahead or you won't be able to eat, that sort of thing. And that seems an important element of the story. Mm.
One last comment.
This is also a story of, like, the woman is the negative side of the anima, always demanding more, more stuff, more material stuff. And so, what he's doing is like a 12-step, you know, material.
That's true. And in this case, the donkey is the higher power. Well, we are about out of time for tonight. Those were the stories I wanted to mention. I will be telling more different tales tomorrow, and again, we'll have the scripts and the active imagination. Let me thank you for all your comments and questions.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.